This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in for Mark Haney. Later in the show, we'll talk with university students from Kenya who are visiting Cincinnati for the first time. Starting off the show today, our country has a long tradition of family farming, and today more than 97% of all U.S. farms are family-owned, ranging in size from a few to thousands of acres. Here to discuss the future of family-owned farms and what it takes to run them are Mark Luff from Fenn Meadows Farm, Pam Shaw from Shaw Farms, and joining us from Columbus by phone, Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association Sustainable Agricultural Educator, Eric Pawlowski. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100 as we talk about the future of family-owned farms. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Pam, let me start with you and tell us a little bit about Shaw Farms.
Our family farm has been in the family for 208 years.
That's a long time.
The state of Ohio was 4 years old, and Thomas Jefferson was president. We've been anything from a dairy farm to a farm that just the family made their livelihood off of. We are now a retail business also. We have both a produce business from July to August, and then September we transition into a massive fall festival that runs clear through October 31st.
And you're located in the Milford area?
Yes.
And I think reading your information, I saw that you had, is it 1,800 acres that you farm?
Yes, give or take, depending from year to year.
Now, how much of that is owned versus do you rent part of that?
Oh, definitely. I would say we own, specifically the business itself owns probably a third of it. There are other family members that own some of it, but we do rent at least half.
And you talk about the retail part. That's kind of like the farmer's market that we're probably familiar with in the summertime.
Yes.
But what do you do besides that? What do you grow besides the vegetables that we see in the summertime?
We grow soybeans and corn.
And then, like you said, then you transition into, I think I read that you're actually the one who started painting pumpkins for the pumpkin display.
Yeah. Yes. Even before I was married into the family, my mother-in-law had me make a head for a scarecrow that she had made, and she sold it before it ever got on the dummy. And I was like, oh, wow, okay, I think I can paint pumpkins. And we've gone much farther than that. We now have many, many buildings that your children can play in and on, and lots of fun things for kids to touch and love and kiss, and great pictures, great photo op.
Mark, you're with Fenn Meadows Farm. Tell us your story.
Okay. My wife and I started Fenn Meadows Farm 5 years ago. Before that, I'd been farming for 4 years. So I graduated in 2007 from Harvard and had a degree in English. And I kind of just went to my parents' basement afterwards because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. Nothing quite felt right. And then 4 years in, we got this opportunity to rent 40 acres on the edge of Indian Hill in Montgomery. And we grow a diversification of lots of different things. We have cattle, hogs, chickens, turkeys, and we do 5 acres of produce. And all of our food is direct marketed to families. So we have 140 members who come and they buy a good part of their groceries at our farm.
Now you, and that was one thing I found interesting about your story, that you did graduate from Harvard. Why farming?
Well, I think when I was a kid, I was really into Laura Ingalls Wilder and old-time farm stuff. And I was always an outdoor person, had a garden at the home. And I just think I told my parents when I went to college that, you know, we can make these payments. So I'll make 100 grand right out of college. I'll be a lawyer and investment banker. Don't worry. And it, you know, there's something in my heart that didn't feel like that's who I was. And so, you know, it just was a process of finding out who I really was.
I have to ask if your parents, you know, when you had promised them $100,000 right out of college to make these payments back for, what was the expression on their face when you said, I want a farm?
Yeah, I got maybe one joke. To my parents' credit, you know, they cracked one joke at me, but they've been 100% supportive. And I credit that partially to my mom was raised on a farm. My grandpa was a farmer, and you know, she respects the profession.
What was that like? There had to be a challenge to being a young farmer, straight out of college. Again, it was in your family, but I'm assuming that maybe not a whole lot of practical experience with farming.
Oh, yeah. I think when I started farming, I was a pretty terrible farmer. I didn't have, you know, the understanding of how to fix things with my hands. I think I had the base where I could learn and grow. But, yeah, I wasn't a great farmer to start up. And, yeah.
Eric, let me turn to you with the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association. Tell us about your organization. What do you do?
Well, the OFA was founded back in 1979 by farmers, consumers, and others working together to create and promote a sustainable and helpful food and farming system. So OFA, you know, is one of the nation's oldest and largest certification agencies for the National Organic Program. We host an annual conference every year in February that brings together you know, the entire spectrum of the food community, from producers to researchers to consumers to processors and marketers. We also host a seasonal farm tour series around the state of Ohio to allow you know, beginning farmers to go out and look at operations that they may want to replicate or to connect a little bit stronger for the consumer to their food sources. We also have workshops for production, or, you know, we processed chickens at one of our seasonal workshops this year. We also talked about appropriate technology and equipment that you can use in the field. We also have had a focus on urban agriculture this last year, and moving ahead to next year, looking ahead to having some more consumer-centric farm tour opportunities for them. So, yeah, we're just active promoting sustainable agriculture in our state.
I was surprised when they gave me the information to put the show together that that 97% of farms are still family-owned, and that surprised me because you think that that they're corporately owned, but and even more surprising, 86% are owned and operated, and they do most of the work themselves.
Yep. We have to learn to be everything. Bookkeepers, veterinarians, you know, we have to understand different types of materials that we're using. And the one thing we can't control is the weather.
To me, that would have to be the biggest gamble when you're looking to do this, that you're, you know, May. And I think the first part of May was sort of dry this year, and then it turned wet, what, maybe the end of May through most of June.
July was awful.
And you have 1,800 acres to get out, and it's raining every other day. And it seemed like just when it was drying up enough that you could do something, it rained again.
The crops were already out. Everything was growing. Corn did very well this year because it was already big enough. But anything that didn't have any size to it succumbed to the rain. For us, our worst crop was pumpkins. Cucurbits don't like a lot of water. They suffer a lot of disease. So we lost about 70% of our crop. A lot of the eastern side of the country lost their crop. So we were all vying for buying loads of pumpkins from anywhere and everywhere that we could get them.
To address your point about the, you know, 97% of farms being family-owned now, I think that's an encouraging statistic, and I think that's something we should continue to strive for. But I maybe on a little more pessimistic note, if you look at the USDA statistics, only 5% of farmers are under the age of 35.
Yeah.
So I think that there is an issue now of people being able to get into farming, and I think unless we correct that, I think that the future may look very different.
Pam, how big is the Shaw family? And I mean, this has been passed down from generation. Obviously, you said this goes back to, well, I think, 1807.
Mm-hmm.
And it stayed in the family.
Right.
But how is the makeup, I mean, how's the makeup of the family changed? For the relatives that could be involved, how many are still involved?
My father-in-law's generation was three sons. Two of them went off to the service and found other jobs. He remained on the family farm. He had four children, two daughters, two sons. The sons stayed in the farming. Now their sons are in the farming. So right now we support five families. But uniquely, our family is still very tied. The three initial brothers, all of their children still have a vested interest in the business. Many of them do things at our fall festival, own a team of horses or face paint, things like that, come and help work, which is wonderful. It's wonderful. The family was very close. So,
do you see that continuing?
I hope so.
And there has to be challenges, though, with that. I know even my family's not that big, but we have disagreements.
Yes.
Sometimes they can be,
yes.
I won't say knockdown dragouts, but they can be, you know,
at the end of the day, we still spend holidays together. So, yeah, that's a hard thing because you don't have a CEO that's separate from everyone else. You know, it's the family. It's mom, dad, grandparents. So,
and now, Mark, you're on the other side of that. You know, they've had 200 years to pass down this tradition. Mm-hmm. You're starting this tradition, and then certainly that has to be a challenge.
Yeah, it is really hard, and I think it's a uniquely hard time. And I don't want to sound too whiny, and I think Claire and I will make a go of it. I think we can make it happen. But one thing you look at now is land prices are very, very high. They've actually doubled since the year 2007. So if you look, and I think a large reason for that is the corn ethanol. And the reason for that is it creates a lot of demand for corn. And then it creates a lot of demand for acreage. And I think that if that law is going to remain in place, we also have to make laws that help farmers to get access to land. Because you look at the interest payment to the bank would be about equal to what your profit would be if you were to grow these conventional crops. So the methods that Claire and I have done have been to shoot for really high profit per acre. And we just intensify using gardens and animal manure. So that's our method to be able to make this happen, but still making that jump to going severely into debt is it's a scary jump, but I think, you know, it's what people are going to have to do to get into this business.
And I think farm financing is a whole different animal compared to regular mortgage financing. If you or I want to go out and buy a piece of property with a house on it to live in, that's one type of financing, but financing for farming is a whole different animal.
Farmers like us, we don't want houses on our property. We want just the ground, you know, and the less utilities that run on the property, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, farm financing is a very interesting subject. And what we've been able to do, we wouldn't be able to do this without our customers. So the 140 families that are in our CSA, they are 80% of all the capital we get each year. The checks show up in the mail, and then we give them discounts on food through the year. So they've kind of filled the gap for us that we couldn't get initially with banks. And the USDA has had a very helpful program for beginning farmers where they offer farm loans to people who the banks traditionally would not loan to.
Eric, what does your organization do to encourage families to stay in the farming business?
Well, we provide a wide variety of support. We're a chapter-based organization, so locally in Ohio, a 3 or 4 county region. We provide those networking opportunities for, you know, not just shared resources, but shared ideas, and building community is really at the heart of what OFA does. We also, you know, my role as sustainable agriculture educator is to be here at the other end of the telephone that when people are looking for transitional opportunities or how to engage with the Farm Service Agency on their rural low-interest loans. Even helping with the application paperwork, connecting with those resources. But, you know, recently here we realized that, farm agriculture financing is its own beast. So we had an independent investment organization come in, and we sponsored the OFA Investment Fund, knowing that some farmers, they will be outside of traditional lending. Maybe they just need a short-term capital loan to deal with some damage or an accident on the farm, or just to, you know, that don't have the upfront input of a CSA program that need to meet their operational costs until they get to harvest. We also have a relationship with one of the social media type Kickstarter programs. It's not Kickstarter, but you know, that one up to $5,000 you can get as a no-interest loan as an OFA member through our relationship with the organization. So, again, you know, you can't necessarily cookie-cutter a farm operation from one to the next, and that's the way we look at resources. Each farm is going to proceed from a unique advantage, but they're also going to have their unique needs, and that's what we want to do is deal individually with the farmer. Yeah, our loan operation is Kiva Zip is the funding source that we go with.
We are talking today about family farming, and we're going to continue that conversation after a short break. You can join the conversation if you have questions, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman. We're discussing family-owned farms and what it takes to run them. Our guests today are Pam Shaw from Shaw Farms, Mark Luff from Fenn Meadows Farm, and joining us from Columbus, Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association Sustainable Agriculture Educator Eric Pulowski. Again, you're invited to join the conversation, 513-419-7100, or email talk at wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, again, 513-419-7100. Again, one of the things I think we touched on briefly that, and these are some statistics that, we found, the average farmer's age is 59 years old. And I think this is what you mentioned, that farmers over 35 outnumber younger farmers by nearly 3 to 1. What's the beginning of turning that around to attract more young people like yourself to farming?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that could change. I think one would be people's attitudes. I think that's a good place to start to look at it as a profession that you can respect, and if your kid to go into that, that you would support them in that. I think access to land is the big thing. I mean, we're getting to this point. We've made our third move here to where we currently are. We've been here 5 years, and we've created a farm that's profitable, returning a lot of profit per acre. We have greenhouses, 12,000 feet of fence, and beautiful black rich soil we've created. And, you know, we don't own the fruits of our labor, and we have to look for what's next, a place that we can own the fruits of our labor. And I think enabling farmers to get land is important, and keeping farmland as farmland is important. And, yeah, I think education, too. I think the OFA is a great organization, where there is a, you know, since we do have this gap where there's, you know, a dwindling number of young farmers, you know, we need that benefit from older farmers where we can get their knowledge and learn from them. And I think we have to keep those avenues open. And OFA is a great organization that does that.
I think with farming, though, it's also very risky, like we said, depending on the weather. And a lot of times children of farmers will opt to go get an education and move on to working something that's a little bit more secure. I have to say, when I became a farmer, the insecurities of the weather drove me crazy. Then when the economy collapsed in 2008 and people were losing their jobs, I was grateful to be a farmer. Because at that point, I knew, you know what? No one's going to give me a pink slip. I'm still going to be a farmer. I may have to cut back, pull on the belt straps because we've had a bad year, but I still have a job.
Erica, what about that question to you, attracting younger folks to farming?
You know, I wasn't born to agriculture. I got involved in through a CSA project in the mid-90s. And, you know, when I first got involved with OFA back then, it was very obvious when you attend the farm tours or the conference workshops that there was a significant age demographic. But here in the last, I'd say, last probably 10 years, I've seen the switch that there is a growing interest in the younger set to come into farming. You know, when you look at some of the statistics, you know, from USDA most recently had some surveys published from 2014. They're saying that, you know, nearly half of all beginning farmers are in that 35 age range. So it takes us, for the allure to come, you know, it takes a certain maturity level of looking at opportunity. And, you know, Edison said opportunity arrives in overalls and looks like work. So it's not something it's a good lifestyle, but it does take effort. Agriculture is, you're teasing it from the soil. So, you know, there's a fairly well-known author out there, Joel Salatin, And one of the things that he's promoting is that you kind of have to make farming sexy. You know, it's got to engage the younger set. And another thing that Joel said is that, you know, a successful farming operation takes three generations. The first generation secures the land. The second generation develops a viable business. And then that critical third generation has to translate that business into the ever-changing dynamic that is American society. So when we look at it, you know, I can only imagine some of the changes that Pam has seen in the 208-year history of her farm and how they went from dairy to grain production to specialty crops to direct marketing and agrotourism. And I'm seeing a strong opportunity right now as we look at the organic price premium. You know, dairy operations really can create the cash flow that would allow you to generate enough cash to pay off a loan. Kind of like what Mark was saying, you know, I've always been a lease operator in my operations because I didn't have that big flux of capital or the advantage of inheriting ground. So it was up to me to develop that viable business that can be replicated as a itinerant or a farmer that has to move from lease to lease. So, yeah, I mean, there are challenges there, but there are support organizations out there like with OFA. Our keynote speaker here coming up for our conference is Lindsay Shute from the National Young Farmers Coalition. You know, they're the ones that represent and engage young farmers to develop their networks and get the resources out there. So, again, it depends on the individual desire. You know, whether they go into specialty crops, livestock, grain production, dairy, then that's how we deal with the individual. What is it, and how can we facilitate them getting to their goals?
Pam, did you want to respond to the three-generation thing?
It's just interesting. It's just interesting is all I can say. It definitely what he said about the first generation secures property and whatnot. The second generation then takes off and says, wow, let's do. And the third generation comes into it, and they've been taught to work. They know how to work, and they're ready to grab it and run with it. It's a very good thing. It's very good.
This is Cincinnati Edition. We're discussing the future of family-owned farms, and thanks to Eric Swartz for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. And if you have a question or comment, 513-419-7100. And let's talk to Cindy in New Richmond. Cindy, you're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for taking my call, and I'm glad to see Pam on there. My name is Cindy Castle. I'm the president of the Farm Bureau Association in Claremont County, and I'm so excited to hear this topic because, as Eric said, there are tons of new opportunities for young farmers to come in and to learn a new business, if not from the seed and field production part. It's definitely, we call it farm-to-table products.
Correct.
Yep. There's a lot of new opportunities we see with alpaca farming and the soap making from goat milk, as well as the jam and some other off-the-farm products that they take to the market. And from a farm bureau perspective, I think that there's other opportunities that we do nationally with the young farmer set, which Eric said that SWOLF is doing as well, and so is the Farm Bureau. We have a national meeting called the Young Farmer Cooperative, and they are 500 to 700 strong every year coming to Columbus to celebrate how they're going to grow their business. So definitely an advocate of the farm business. We actually raise buffalo in New Richmond. I'm 50 Branch Buffalo, and it's definitely something that is a way of life and an advocation as well as opportunity to create a business. So it's been a fun opportunity and definitely support the opportunities for farming. Good talk. Good topic today.
All right, Cindy, we appreciate your call. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'd like to maybe just jump in. I think it's worth maybe opening up that USDA data at home. I'm pretty sure the numbers are, it's actually about 15%. I was just looking at it before I came, of beginning farmers are under the age of 35. I know we've had a few different numbers on that, but I'm very encouraged by the you know, the interest of the young farmers that are out there and the beginning farmers of all ages. But I do still think that we're not quite there in terms of where we need to be for for growth. And I would just, maybe something we could do is just ask around, you know, who do we know that is doing, getting into this? And at least around here in the Cincinnati area, it's pretty hard to find connections with people doing what Claire and I are doing over there. And I still think we're very much on the low end of the curve of creating a sustainable, where there's going to be enough replacement for the older generation.
We've got a couple other calls I want to get to here, but quickly, we're sitting in a room full of technology. 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have cell phones that we can wear. Farm technology certainly has advanced.
Absolutely.
But one thing that doesn't seem to have changed, farming is still very labor intensive.
Yeah, very.
And to someone who's thinking about getting into it, it's like, do I really want to work that hard?
You know what? And I've thought that several times through this conversation, because I think that's where farmers like us that are generational already lose some of our children, because do you really want to work that hard? And maybe make a great living that year, and maybe not. And then there's healthcare, which is something we have to provide for ourselves. And that's a challenge in itself.
Let's go to David in Winton Way. David, you're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. I run Wooden Shoe Gardens, and I'm the fifth generation on the land here. And I really liked what Eric said about agriculture being multi-generational. And I think if you look at it through that lens, it might not necessarily mean that it's bad that there's not many young farmers, because the way agriculture used to work, you took over when your parents retired. So the person in charge of the farm was between 40 and 70 years old, but the farm was also supporting the next generation as they were coming up. And so I don't necessarily think that we have to figure out ways to start new farms, but we might have to figure out ways to get the next generation to transition into agriculture in a seamless way that might not be as traditional as, you know, parent to child like we used to have.
Okay, David, we appreciate your call. Pam, you talk about keeping, you know, your kids involved, but when we talk about the labor, so what about that point?
Well, my children are in their late 20s and 30s, and we've always worked together, so it was kind of something that, it was wonderful to be a farmer, where we were proud, and they just stepped into it, and they love it, you know, and they're ready to take off with it. They really are. I agree with what the gentleman just said, though. I don't think it's necessary that we have a lot of 20-year-old farm owners like what you are. I think it's wonderful what you're doing, Mark, because I do think that there's the older generation that still is in charge, but will hand it down to the next generation.
Let's talk to Tony in Clifton. Tony, go ahead.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question. More looking for a reaction. I'm coming from the technology space, and I know there have been several comments about technology and improvements for agriculture. But one thing that's also been talked at length has been just the weather and the effects that can have on what's grown. I'm wondering, as farm owners, what the expansion of indoor controlled farming has had on your businesses and how you see that playing a part in the future.
Pam?
In our farming, we don't do what's considered high tunnel, so we don't have that indoor. I know, Mark, you do, because I saw it on your website. I think high tunnel is definitely the future of vegetable crop gardening, things like that. It extends our seasons. I know that there's a large area in Cleveland, I believe, that has things growing all winter long in their high tunnels. Greens like your kale and your Brussels sprouts and things like that.
Yeah, I think that high tunnels are going to be a big part of the agriculture here in Ohio going forward, because, you know, one day it's 20 and the next it's 80. So it's not quite like California, but we have a lot of rain when California doesn't. So for our farm, the next we do some high tunnel work, and we're going to keep adding those as every time we have a little bit of money. But I think the next frontier is mobile high tunnels, and there's people doing that around the country.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask the obvious question. I'm assuming a high tunnel is the same thing as a greenhouse.
Yeah, it is.
But you plant in the ground instead of in pots.
Okay.
Yeah. So ours is about 30 by 80 foot. That's our biggest one.
Eric, you want to weigh in on high tunnels?
Well, I'm going to tease that question a little bit different, you know, because I think that he was talking about more like hydroponic, aquaponic systems, you know, and even the high tunnel, you know, that is a component of a diversified farm operation. Both of our other guests mentioned that it's a season extension technique. So, yeah, I don't think that I've ever seen any competition from hydroponic production. Because the secret is in the soil. The National Organic Program standards are about soil maintenance. So maintaining your soil. And when we look at the some of the 10 global issues that we're challenged with, you know, food security, available water, climate change, waste disposal, extinction of biodiversity, soil degradation and desertification, instability, social instability, rapid population increase. You know, the solutions to all these things lies in proper soil management. You know, carbon sequestration. I can do that much easier by building the organic matter in my soil and keeping my pastures perennial than I can by trying to alleviate the deforestation down in the rainforest. I think that you can turn a lot of these climatic challenges with around through more regenerative techniques of maintaining your soil structure.
Let's get one more call in here before we have to wrap up. Tim from Lebanon, go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. We just had an appraisal on a property here in Lebanon, Warren County, and I went to the meeting with the auditor, and he mentioned that the farmers' taxes have really shot out of sight because of low interest rates. Now, he said he had some kind of complicated formula where you take the price of corn times something else.
CAUV.
Exactly.
You divide this by the interest rates. And people in the state government, they don't care about these farmers. They want this development. They want this farmland taken over for development where they can get more taxes, more money in their coffers. So how do we... You know, you mentioned we got to keep farmland. How do we do that? What can the state government do to help that situation?
I think I was thinking about this on the way over. I think one thing might be zoning laws. You know, you decide that, you know, near the city we should have X number of acres and farms that can help to serve our local community. But I also don't want that zoning laws to be limiting on the farmer because, you know, there's many opportunities on a farm for additional income streams, such as I guess like Pam was talking about with the, you know, farm to table events. You got the places where consumers can come out, and I don't want the laws to limit the ability of the farmer to add some new income streams.
Pam, I'm going to give you the last word because we are running out of time.
I don't know how to comment on this. I know the CAUVs was horrible, and it hit us tough. I know Farm Bureau has been actively working to try to help us on that. And it wasn't every county, but a great amount of land was in Clinton County, and it was hit real hard last year. And that's tough. That's really tough because that's income that you already had allotted for other areas, and now all of a sudden you're paying it in taxes.
We have been talking about the future of family-owned farms. Our guests were Pam Shaw with Shaw Farms, Mark Luff from Finn Meadows Farm, and Eric Pawlowski, sustainable agriculture educator with the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we talk with students from Kenyatta University in Nairobi who are here visiting and the UC professor who arranged their trip after he spent time teaching in Kenya. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.